Gavin Strawn has won plenty of awards as a writer, but until now he's not written a book. And Gavin's choosing a song this morning on What I'm Listening To. He's helped create TV shows like Nothing Trivial, Filthy Rich, Jackson's Wharf, Mercy Peak, the futuristic thriller This Is Not My Life. He co-wrote the feature film Matariki. He honed his craft, as they say, on soaps like Neighbours in Australia and Shortland Street here. And he's also worked out of the UK and Germany. In fact, he's simply worked on too much drama to mention and in various roles. Now comes a new book from Gavin, a thriller called The Call, because the action in it begins with a call. There's a policewoman called Honey as the main character. She's tough, but she's kind. She has to protect an informant who's scared out of her wits. And there's a gang that's already exacted cruel revenge on Honey and badly wants to do so on the informant. It's all a recipe for fast-paced suspense. Gavin Strawn, kia ora.
Kia ora.
The idea for The Call, which you began when we were all in lockdown, the idea came from a long lunch you had with three female detectives. What were you told that actually finds its way directly into your book, and it's fascinating?
Well, just to clarify, it was three cops, one uniform cop, one cop that worked in IT, and one detective,
right,
who were all women.
Sounds better saying three.
That's right. And it was a very long, boozy lunch, which my sometimes screenwriting colleague, Rachel Lang, and I had taken these three women out to lunch to research a show. And one of them, maybe it was after a few wines, she mentioned that she'd been a bit loose and free with her phone number and had mentioned that the girlfriend of a guy that was involved in a gang had started ringing her often late at night, and especially after she'd had a domestic with her boyfriend, and would give away little tidbits and snippets of gang activity. And it was, you know, to get back at him. And also they formed a relationship and she had someone to talk to. But because this was a cop and she, you know, they put on a hard front, she also said that it got so annoying. It was, you know, it was a mixed conversation. But it was also one of those conversations where they talked about what it was like being women in the police force, being on surveillance, and the men could just wee into a bottle, but what does a woman do? And it was the sexism in the police force and all those kind of things as well.
But in terms of a woman involved with a gang member telling tales on her boyfriend, which when I encountered that in the book, it seemed like a plot device that you'd made up for obvious reasons because it propelled everything along. But in fact, it came from real life. That's the interesting thing.
Well, even more than that, it was all that I had to start with. I did not have a plot. I had a detective that I had been trying to write as a character for a long time, playing with in my mind, who ended up as Detective Honey Chalmers. And I had an informant who I knew nothing about apart from the fact that she was annoying and rang late at night. Mm. And when I sat down and decided I would write it as a novel, that was all I had, and I just started there.
Without giving too much of the plot away, which is always the trouble when we talk about thrillers and such, fiction generally, how much else from your life gets a look in here? Can we go through a bit of that? So you have a detective who's a woman named Honey Chalmers. Why Honey?
Honestly, I don't know. If I examined it, I would go, I think there was a Peter Carey story that involved a character called Honey, and I loved the contradiction between a tough character and a name that she had no choice in.
Right.
I mean, it comes from history of writing in television, and where you make up names for characters, and producers so often say, oh, she, you know, can't we give her a different, you know, nicer name? And you just go, they didn't know what they were going to be like when their parents named them. So I guess there's an inherent wry comment in the name. But honestly, the name came first. That's what started me off.
Yeah, you make a good point about not necessarily conjuring up names that you think suit people, because they don't always. And after she is badly bashed in this thriller, Honey gets leave from the police and she goes out to the black sand beaches south of Auckland to recover and to look after her mum, who has a degree of dementia. There is also the matter of her younger sister, Scarlett, who has committed suicide many years before, and why remains a mystery. You know this neck of the woods, don't you?
In this case, when I first came back from working in London for a couple of years, the turn of the millennium, we moved to a sort of biodegradable solar-powered house on the Ofitu Peninsula, and I was working on various projects from there and commuting occasionally into town. But basically, we were growing veggies and keeping chooks and living the good life. And my children went to the local school there. And we did that for a few years. But then when my daughter became old enough to go to intermediate school, it got a bit difficult. And my son was at high school. And so we ended up moving into town. Anyway, obviously a big slice of my life, but cut to 20 years later when I was writing this book, I wasn't referring that deliberately. I just knew what country towns were like and country life.
Yeah.
But I also grew up in the back of the Adelaide Hills in the back blocks.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about that. All right, so you know all about biodegradable houses. What a great idea that is. You wrote a piece in Newsroom Online in reply to writer Steve Brawnius, who had reviewed The Call approvingly. It was a nice review, but he had asked how you write your Māori characters, and you wrote, quote, "I asked the most Māori dude I know for advice, and David Seymour told me not to sweat it. He said all New Zealanders were the same, we all came from the same starting point, so why did I have to focus on Māori characters at all?" Which is quite funny. Later in the piece, though, you acknowledge that some stories are not yours to tell. But in fact, your writing career has had you steeped in treaty issues and Māoritanga in the past, hasn't it?
It has, and I still approach the subject with great caution and a little bit of fear. I mean, it's a difficult area, and the situation has changed in New Zealand. When I wrote What Really Happened Waitangi, which I'm really proud of and I think was a really good piece of work, I had amazing Māori mentors like Mary Mary Penfold and Witty Amira and to help me sort of work my way through it. But I also felt I had a certain advantage as an Australian coming to New Zealand in that I didn't bring any baggage with me. I was looking at this historical situation and trying to dramatise it. And I could kind of look at it a little bit more scientifically, I think, in a funny way, before I got immersed in all the material.
Well, speaking of that, a main character in your book is a mysterious man named Marshall, who re-enters the life of your heroine, Honey Chalmers. Now, he is strong and silent, and he lives alone. And I think you got that idea from a Māori woman who lived in Iceland.
Well, when I say I got that idea, my starting point, again, these things make sense in retrospect when you think them through. I met a woman in Iceland when I was on some television workshop program years ago, and I was talking to her, and she said she had to get... And I said, what are you doing in Iceland?
Yeah.
And she said, in a way, she had to get as far away from New Zealand as she could to find herself, because the pressures of whānau and all the expectations that were placed on her when she was in New Zealand were... You know, she found it, she needed to get away. And I've got no idea what happened to her. Honestly, this was 25 years ago. But seeds like that get planted. And when you're looking at a character, I wanted a guy with a, you know, troubled past who had left New Zealand and had various adventures before he returned, which had created a kind of complex character. I also wanted to give him a past history with Honey's sister so that she didn't know if she could trust him or not, because, you know, I felt in a way he's too good to be true, so therefore he needs not to be too good to be true. And a good reader will read that and go, uh-oh, wait a minute. And so they'll be on Honey's side as they're going through it and going, can they trust him or not?
Gavin Strawn is with us, and the book is called The Call. The issue, the justice or lack of which we don't all really understand, comes to the fore in your book, the ability of the Australian government to revoke visas for people who become our 501s. Well over 2,000 of them have been deported back here, and they have increased the level of criminality in New Zealand. And we understand how that can happen legally, but of course not always morally. And their clashes with a local gang here in your book generate the plot. And you'd already done research on gangs and drugs as well, hadn't you?
Oh, that's right. Before and during lockdown and after, I'd been working with a Māori writer-director called Kerry Carter, and he had been developing a project called Chasing Pure, which was had a family connections for him. It was based on the amphetamine trade in a methamphetamine trade in New Zealand. And we'd worked with him on developing that into a TV series. We got some development money, but unfortunately we couldn't find production funding, so it went away. But in the process, I'd talked to Jared Savage and people like that, and we'd done a lot of research on gangs.
And this is interesting. You also drew on your own background as a bit of a young tearaway in South Australia. Let's talk about that a bit.
Do we have to?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yes. So in my late teens and early 20s, I left school when I was 16, and I worked in various jobs. I worked in the Northern Territory for a mining company. I worked as a fruit picker, and I did hay carting and all sorts of jobs like that. And at that time, I rode a motorcycle. I think it was a Beza 650 that I'd restored, an old BSA. It might have been a Honda 754. I'm not sure. It was a long time ago. And at some time, a group of guys moved into the district and started drinking at the local pub. And their leader was, and this sounds like a joke, but it's true, their leader was called Patch. And he was really charismatic. I mean, he was funny. He was smart. And it was really interesting because it wasn't like he was their official leader. They weren't a patched gang. They were just a group of guys that took over a share house, probably sold drugs, and hung out. But the thing was, I got to see a side. I played pool against them in the pub and we'd drink. And, you know, they were funny and all the rest of it. And I've told this story, but then they raped a friend of mine.
Mm.
And it was just this extraordinary moment of going around to her house. And she wasn't, I mean, she was tough as nails as well. And she didn't give it away straight away. And I went around to see her. And then she mentioned they'd all come over. When my bike had pulled up, she'd been scared because they'd come around a couple of nights before. But that was a long time ago. And then cut to 40 years later. And again, when I came to characterising these people, I think that's why my characters are not black and white, because I have sort of been on the other side a bit.
The thing is, as I know to a small extent, you can talk to charismatic gang leaders and to gang members and even get to know them. And they, of course, they're human beings. They're not monsters. They often don't want their children to go into gangs. They can be capable of great acts of kindness. But together, because this is a big part of your book, I mean, together the mentality is different. The collective brain is different, isn't it?
Yeah, and there is some reflection on the book in that people do what they're kind of destined to do because of the situation they're in.
Mm.
So you set things up in a certain way and the outcomes are kind of predictable.
The outcome of your book is in fact not predictable. I suppose that's a compliment, actually. You know, you read books and you see things coming and you can work them out often in general terms, and yours has got a twist in the tail.
It has got a twist. Again, it wasn't pre-planned. Like I said, I began with the characters. The plot started to reveal itself. And I don't want to sound mystical either, because it's all technical. You just sit down and write and one thing leads to another. And you reach a certain point where you make decisions. There's lots of crossroads in the process of writing. But each decision leads to a certain other place. And then you reach a point where you feel the only honest decision takes you to other places.
Oh, what other places are those, Gavin? In fact, I've mentioned this before, and listeners who heard the original interview will remember it from before too, but Lee Child told us that's how he writes. He lies down on the couch and closes his eyes, then he begins the book, and he has no idea where it's going to lead. And he has to write accordingly, because he's found himself as a writer in certain situations he has to get out of.
Well, that's right. And there's a famous story about David Chase, I think, when he was writing The Sopranos, and everybody talked about the relation of Tony Soprano with his mother. And David Chase said, yes, that's my relationship with my mother. I just didn't think anyone would be interested in a writer's relationship with his mother.
Well, this book, I suppose, lends itself to televisual treatment. What's next in your life as a writer? Now that you've got this under your belt, finally, the big novel.
I'm very excited that Alan and Unwin have asked me to write another one.
Right. also starring Honey Chalmers.
That's right, yeah.
Featuring Detective Honey Chalmers.
Okay. Yeah, that's where I want to pick up the ball and see where it takes me next.
We'll be interested to see where it takes you next. Oh, we've asked you to choose a song just as a special reward for coming in. So what have you got for us?
Well, Let the Light In is something I've been thrashing a lot lately, just because it's got a wonderful mix of melancholy and optimism, which are my two favourite things stuck together. So, Let the Light In with Lana Del Rey and Father John Misty.
Here it comes, in your honour. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.